This is Radio EcoShock.
Suddenly, all the official sources are wringing their hands about the coming climate catastrophe. The accountants, like PricewaterhouseCoopers, the bankers, even the World Bank, and the International Energy Agency. Professor Kevin Anderson of Britain's Tyndall Center has warned us the emperor has no clothes as the system of climate denial breaks down. What does it really mean? You are about to hear a knockout speech by Guy McPherson. He's the professor who left his tenured position at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources to build his straw bale house and live in rural anarchy. Guy's popular blog is called Nature Bats Last at guymcpherson.com. His latest book is Walking Away from Empire. On November 2, 2012, McPherson spoke at the Bluegrass Bioneers Conference in Louisville, Kentucky. His stand-up performance was captured by organizer and filmmaker Ben Evans from Yurt.com. The video was posted on YouTube as a comedy, and there was some nervous laughter as McPherson landed blow after blow of the awful truth about climate change. I'm Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. I prepared this audio for nonprofit radio broadcast. Off mic, McPherson told his audience he has some really horrible news and some good news. You might not like either one. Here is Guy McPherson.
The good news is this set of living arrangements is nearly done. In the not-too-distant future, we'll have no water coming out of the municipal taps, no food at the grocery store, no fuel at the filling station, no lights on here in the Empire. According to these 80 people, that'll happen by the end of this year. Now, some of these people have been wrong. Some of them have been wrong many times. Some of them haven't been wrong yet, but I bet they will be, because we only got 2 months to go. So it wouldn't surprise me if a long decline will end with a sudden and cataclysmic collapse of the world's industrial economy, which has been declining since 1999 or 2000, depending on which metric you use. So for a dozen years or so, we've been in decline of the industrial economy. If you think that can't happen quickly, that an empire can't fall relatively quickly, think about the events of the late 1980s and early 1990s. The last superpower didn't take a dozen years to fall. This is good news because if we stop this omnicidal, suicidal set of living arrangements that we call industrial civilization, then that will actually force us to stop climate chaos, which threatens us with near-term extinction. It will force us to stop human population overshoot, which proceeds currently at the rate of more than 200,000 individuals per day added to the planet. That's births minus deaths. 200,000 people per day brought into the world that they didn't choose to be brought into. It's not like we vote for that. We just appear here. Nobody chose this time in history. And we don't have food for those people. We don't have clean water. We don't have clean air for all those people we're adding every day. And there's 7 billion plus of us now. At what point do we stop the madness on an overpopulated planet? When the industrial economy collapses, and I'm not saying that it will happen this year or next year, but it will happen. The set of living arrangements will come to an end. All civilizations fall, including industrial civilization. When that happens, we'll be forced to slow or stop the sixth great extinction, which is proceeding apace at 200 species a day, every single life-destroying day. 200 species a day. That's genocide. That's what the industrial economy allows us and apparently forces us to do. 200 species a day, as if we have the right. And finally, termination of the set of living arrangements will force us to stop environmental decay. And here I'm thinking about every part of the world that has become worse every year of my 52 years on the planet. Everybody I know thinks every year has been better than the year before because we've got iPads and Kindles, right? But from my perspective, every year has been worse than the year before. Every year we have more soil that we wash into the world's oceans. Every year we foul more air and dirty more water. Every year we destroy every aspect of the living planet that we actually need to survive. And we think it's cool because we have smartphones. Let's make the right trade. And here comes the bad news. And most people stop right here, by the way. Most people stop with Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change with their five-year-old assessment of 1°C in 88 years. And we know so much more than that now. For a couple of reasons, we have an abundance of data. We're collecting climate data on an enormous level. And the models are so much better than they were 5 years ago. You probably know Moore's Law and the rapidity with which computational speed is increasing. So we know better than this, yet most people stop right here. By the way, 1°C is catastrophic. We've been convinced by a neoclassical economist, of all things, that 2 degrees C is something we should worry about. William Nordhaus somehow hijacked the conversation and said 2 degrees C is something to be worried about, 1 degree is no big deal. 1 degree is a big deal, as we've known for more than 20 years. 1 degree C temperature increase leads to rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could, will, and have lead to extensive ecosystem damage. We've known this for over 20 years. This is one of the greatest cover-ups by the corporate media I've ever heard about. Hadley Center for Meteorological Research, hardly a left-wing organization, comes out a year after the IPCC with more computational power and more data and concludes that we're headed to a 2 degrees C warmer world by the end of the century. And 2 degrees is truly catastrophic. 2 degrees, because of positive feedbacks or self-reinforcing feedback loops, leads almost immediately and with great certainty to 6 degrees C. And the last time it was 6 C warmer on this planet than baseline, there were snakes the size of yellow school buses living in the Amazon, and the largest mammal on the planet was the size of a shrew. That's the largest mammal that can thermoregulate that kind of wet bulb temperature. This is huge, and nobody talks about it. President Obama expressed considerable surprise at an interview earlier this week that climate change didn't come up during the debates. Really? The scripted debates that you approved every damn question, climate change didn't come up? I'm shocked. We don't talk about this. It's too scary. United Nations Environment Program, 6 months after the Hadley Center's assessment. Hadley Center, let me tell you how left-wing they are. They were established by Margaret Thatcher. Some of us know. Many of you are too young to know. United Nations Environment Program comes along mid-2009 says we're headed for a 3.5 degrees C warmer world by 2100. I'm halfway through these assessments, by the way. Wow. Hadley Center comes along just a year after their most recent assessment, says 4 is the new 2, and it's coming by mid-century. Remember, 2 leads to 6. 4 is the last nail in the coffin of the human experience. Consistent with that assessment, the Global Carbon Project and the Copenhagen diagnosis, at the time of the Copenhagen climate change meetings that the Obama administration threw under the bus, came up with 6 and 7 degrees C warming by the end of the century. International Energy Agency, with their World Energy Outlook that they produce every year the day after Thanksgiving, gee, nobody notices then. Probably a coinkydink. I don't know. IEA says in November of 2010 that we're headed to 3.5 degrees C warmer world by 2035. That's a big deal. By 2030, that's not very long from now, if I'm doing the math right. United Nations Environment Program, December of 2010, says more than 5 degrees C by 2050. More than 5 degrees C kills the oceans. The ocean becomes so acidified that essentially nothing can live there, including the thermophiles found at incredible depths at enormous temperatures. Phytoplankton in the ocean produce half our oxygen, by the way. I think we're going to have a hard time getting along without that. It's almost as if we might experience rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. Stop me if you've heard that one before. And finally, the International Energy Agency, just a year after their previous assessment, comes up with 6 degrees C by 2035. Wow! Less than 6 months later, they either capitulated or clarified what they were trying to say. And they said, no, we didn't mean by 2035. Even though you can find the press release online, that's exactly what it says. They said, we meant 2100. Curious. The good news is that none of these assessments include economic collapse. The bad news, and you knew it was coming, is that none of them include positive feedbacks. Self-reinforcing feedback loops, none. These all assume simple linear projections from 1 year to the next, from 1 decade to the next. Let's talk about those positive feedback loops. The only major assessment that I know about was conducted more than a year ago, so it's ancient history at this point, by the National Center for Atmospheric Research. They conclude we're headed for 16 degrees C increase by 2100. It's kind of a big deal. And climate scientist Paul Beckwith at the University of Ottawa, the middle of last month, pointed out that we could observe a 6 degrees C temperature increase within a decade because of positive feedbacks. It's almost as if, stop me if you've heard this one, we could experience rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. I think that's about right. We've known this for 22 years. Just when you think it can't get any worse, I have another slide. According to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, one of the premier science journals in the entire world, in a paper published in February 2009, so a long time ago now, climate change is irreversible. What the paper actually found was that the atmospheric level of carbon dioxide today is the minimum level we'll observe for at least the next 1,000 years. So we're at an average carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere right now of 396 parts per million. And we will be at 396 parts per million for at least the next 1,000 years. That's the minimum. 350.org is a bad joke. It's disingenuous or ignorant. There is no way we'll see 350.org, 350 parts per million CO2 within at least the next 1,000 years. Promoting that as if we could get there is ridiculous. United Nations Environment Program, during 2008, the most catastrophic year of the catastrophic Great Recession. We can't call them depressions anymore because that's too depressing. So we call them recessions now. Big ones. Great recessions. That's great. That was great for me. It wasn't good for you.
Very recessing.
During 2008, global carbon emissions increased to their highest level since we fully implemented the Clean Air Act in this country. But that was nothing compared to what was coming. 2009, we increased over that record-setting year by 6.2%. 2010, we increased over that record-setting year by 6.5%. 2011, we increased over that record-setting year by 3.4%. We're in an economic Great Depression, and carbon emissions keep going up. We can't just slow the industrial economy. Instead, only economic collapse will prevent runaway climate change. There's an amazing story behind this paper. Tim Garrett from the University of Utah submitted this paper to 10 journals before he could find one that would publish it. And then it was published in Climatic Change, one of the premier journals in climate sciences. He submitted it there in February 2007. It was accepted and printed online in November of 2009. And there was immediately a big outcry from the scientific community who said, no, we can't stop this set of living arrangements. That would be bad. So before it was published, it was held back for nearly 2 years so that people could write responses. So there are two responses to this article to which Garrett was not allowed to respond that were published at the same time as the print version of his paper. This is politics severely interfering with science, in my opinion. It sort of reminds me, when I go on speaking tours, I sometimes ask the host, if I'm speaking at a high school or for younger students, I ask if I should maybe not talk about economic collapse because some people find that depressing, oddly. But that's my good news. And I was speaking in New York last year, and I wrote to the science coordinator at the school where I was going to be speaking, and I said, so a lot of times people don't want me to talk about economic collapse to high school students, so I won't talk about that if that's okay. And she said, yeah, that would be bad. We don't want to upset the kids. I said, okay, tongue in cheek. I'm just kidding. I said, how about if I talk about, oh, I don't know, three paths to near-term human extinction? She says, that'd be great. If a paper in Bioscience earlier this year, a prestigious academic journal, researchers went and translated Thoreau's extensive notes from the 1840s, a series of years in the 1840s, right before the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Most people peg that at 1850. So Thoreau was out there around Concord, Massachusetts, collecting extensive information on the first flowering dates of all the plants in the area. He was quite the naturalist. And somebody went through and transcribed all those notes, which were essentially unreadable, because apparently his handwriting was even worse than mine. And they transcribed all those and figured out the first flowering dates of all the plants in the area around Concord, Massachusetts. And then they went out in the late 2000s, so between 2005 and the following few years, and collected the same information. And what they found was, if we believe the plants instead of the sensors, the area around Concord, Massachusetts is actually warmed by about 2.4 degrees centigrade. The sensors all indicate that that area has warmed by 1 degree. I'm more inclined to believe the plants than our instruments. If we believe the plants, we're already at 2 degrees C. And I suspect that's why we're seeing numerous positive feedbacks, six of which I know we've triggered, first five of which lead to near-term human extinction. So I want to talk about those feedbacks briefly. All these were reported relatively recently. The scientific community is unbelievably conservative. That's why most scientists are still using the IPCC's fourth assessment, 5 years old, and waiting for the next assessment, which is due out in 2 years, to base their next projections on. Based on data from the summer of 2010, this paper appeared in January 2011 in Science and pointed out that the Arctic is defrosting because warm Atlantic water is shooting up through the Fram Strait off the north and east coasts of Greenland directly into the Arctic Sea. So we have warm Atlantic water that previously always reversed course at Greenland as part of the thermohaline conveyor belt, And instead of reversing course, now it's just shooting straight up through the Fram Strait off the north and east coast of Greenland, taking warm Atlantic water into the Arctic. First time that's been reported in recorded history. It was 2010, a signature year for climate studies. I suspect we're going to see an ice-free Arctic within the next 3 years. If so, it'll be the first time for 3 million years before there were human beings on the planet, in other words. It'll be the first time in 3 million years there'll be an ice-free Arctic. We're on path for that to happen in 2014 or 2015. From various other sources, the first four of these are peer-reviewed science papers. We have five other positive feedbacks, any one of which, again, leads to the direction we don't want to go. The first of those is peat in the world's boreal forests, which is decomposing very rapidly. As the water table falls, peat is exposed to the air. It decomposes and becomes carbon in the atmosphere almost immediately, contributing to warming and drying of the atmosphere, which causes the water table to decline, which exposes more peat to the air, which causes it to decompose, which causes warming and drying. So that's a classic positive feedback. In Siberia, on the ground, the permafrost is melting so rapidly that methane is being vented from the ground. So you can see this stuff on YouTube. In 2010, again, a signature year for climate studies, 2010, researchers would go out to Siberia, and they'd find these vents, and they were about 30 centimeters in diameter, about a foot across, and they would light them on fire, because this is what scientists do. They play with fire. I know, I was a scientist for a long time. I know, it's really thrilling stuff. Look, Mom. And there's a big Roman candle, right? Really cool. That was 2010. 2011, those methane events were a kilometer across. It's almost as if, stop me if I've heard this before, there will be rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses. Three orders of magnitude increase in the size of those vents in 1 year. That's rapid. That's unpredictable. That's amazing. At the same time, we can light Siberia on fire. Methane is also escaping from the world's oceans, and particularly in the Arctic. There are methane hydrates or clathrates. Those are synonyms, little cages of methane that are floating up to the surface as the ocean warms, and then the methane is being released into the atmosphere. Methane is about 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide in the short term, 20 to 30 times more powerful molecule for molecule than carbon dioxide in the long term, over 100 years or so, but we don't have 100 years. 2011, someplace in the Arctic, it looked like ginger ale, because the methane was bubbling out so quickly. And then again from 2010, a drought in the Amazon that was so profound that just as a result of natural decomposition, natural drying, natural decomposition of the Amazon forest, which is supposed to be a net sequesterer of carbon, instead, decomposition was proceeding so quickly that the Amazon basin released more carbon than all the cars, trucks, and coal-fired power plants in the United States combined in 2010. It's supposed to be the lungs of the planet, and they're giving up all that carbon dioxide. In 2010, producing more carbon into the atmosphere than the entire United States. We're number one. And then the most recent, the one that's now reported in the Referee Journal literature and won't be for 15 years, it's such a slow process, is drilling in the Arctic. And so the more there's open water, the more it allows us to go up there and drill for oil and gas. And then we burn it, and that makes the water more open. You know where this goes. The Arctic Methane Emergency Group looks at one of those positive feedbacks, methane, in one region in the Arctic, and concludes that in 2010, not surprisingly, it appears that methane has gone exponential. That's 2010 right there on the right-hand side with the red dots going straight up. And the author is Malcolm Light. This came out February of this year. And Malcolm Light predicts extinction by mid-century. And I'm going to read here. Okay. Methane release will accelerate exponentially. He reports that it has accelerated exponentially. Release huge quantities of methane into the atmosphere and lead to the demise of all life on Earth before the middle of this century. He pegged it to, for the Northern Hemisphere, to 2031. 0.6, I left off the decimal place. He's a scientist. September. Look for that in September in the Northern Hemisphere. And 2047, 0.8 in the Southern Hemisphere. All life on Earth. And I thought that was hyperbolic when I first read it, because I thought, thermophiles? How are you going to kill thermophiles? Methane-eating bacteria? But then I thought about, well, you know, that there would be rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. And so, yeah, it might kill everything. It certainly is the end of the line for the human experience when we get to those kinds of conditions. At this point, I would like you to breathe. I put that in there just to remind me. Just tell everybody to breathe and act like it's going to be okay. even though obviously it's not. We can tell ourselves little lies. I didn't eat ice cream for lunch. Okay, so now what? What do we do in the face of this information? Most people I know will just run from it, right? We'll pretend that this never happened. So I went and had an affair, so you'll deny that you ever knew me. Guy who? No, never heard of him. So what I suggest we do is to channel little Springsteen. In the end, what you don't surrender, well, the world just strips away. So let go. Let go. Or be dragged. Seize the day. Or, to quote my own personal hero, live as though the day were here. I'm over being judgmental about the way people live. I think we don't have a long time left on this planet. And if you're living in the interior of a large continent in the northern hemisphere, you are truly, totally in trouble. Live as though the day were here. Now I have the really good news. It'll have to be really good, won't it? I mean, the bar here has got to be high, right?
Yeah.
Can't believe you're all still here. And I'm still alive. This is stunning on two counts already. We're amazing. You're amazing. We're all of it. I'm not doing the Tony Robbins thing here. We really are amazing. You get to die. You get to die. And that makes you the lucky one. The lucky ones. Because you got to live. You know what the odds are? You know what we know from DNA, from our knowledge of DNA? You know what the odds are against any one of us being here? They're astronomical. Think about plucking a single grain of sand from all the world's beaches. That doesn't come close. The odds against any one of us being here are greater than the odds against plucking a single atom from our entire universe. And yet, here you are. In the teeth of these stupefying odds, it is you and I that are privileged to be here, privileged with eyes to see where we are and brains to wonder why. And now you're thinking, why? Why did I come here? Why? No, I mean why in the greater sense. What underlies the Armageddon we have triggered? And it is Armageddon. You can't call 200 species a day merely an extinction crisis. It's Armageddon. We have triggered Armageddon. We've been pursuing it for quite a long time. What underlies it is our drive to consume. The way we live, particularly in this country, like this, suburbia, not quite city, not quite country, requires us to live far from where we work, far from where we play, far from where we shop for all the things we think we need with the money we don't have. Forces us to consume. What underlies the industrial economy of the United States? 70% of it is underlain by personal consumption. In the wake of 9/11, how do we get out of that mess? Go to the mall. That's what your president said. Go to the mall. Got to consume our way back on track to greatness. Consume. Consume to do away with completely. Destroy, to spend wastefully, to squander. It's almost biblical, really, to what? To waste or burn away, to perish. And this is a good thing? This is the best they can tell us? Is to consume? To maintain this set of living arrangements requires obedience at home, oppression abroad, and whole-scale destruction of the living planet on which we depend for our actual lives. Just think about oppression abroad, for example. Anybody gets in the way of our oil, we kill them. It's that simple. That's the Carter Doctrine. The last decent man in the Oval Office, Jimmy Carter, comes up with the doctrine that says, with respect to the Middle East, that's our oil over there. Jimmy Carter, the Marcus Aurelius of his day, knew what it took to maintain an empire in decline. Obedience at home? Well, that panel is from Alabama, when in the wake of the great financial crisis in September 2008, citizens were legally protesting illegal actions by local banks, and in response, the National Guard was illegally brought in to quash the protests. That's just a minor example of obedience at home. If you want more, look to the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act 2012, signed in the dark of night on New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2011, in which, for the first time since passage of the Magna Carta in 1215, we suspend habeas corpus in peacetime. And nobody says a thing. That's the astonishing part of this. We suspend habeas corpus in the civilized world for the first time since passage of the Magna Carta, and nobody says a word. Well, Chris Hedges and a couple other guys sue, and they win in court, and the Obama administration ignores that. Here's another example of obedience at home. In 2000, when George W. Bush was running for president of the United States, he would speak on college campuses, and occasionally a lone student would stand up and express his or her First Amendment rights, freedom of expression, turn his or her back on the future president of the United States and stand in silent protest. Other students would notice they'd stand up and turn their back too. In some places, a third or a half of the students, by the time George W. Bush was done speaking, had their backs turned to him. It was massively underreported, but it happened all over the country. That's the year 2000. Fast forward 10 years, one decade, Hillary Clinton is speaking in Washington, D.C., and a well-known man in Washington, D.C. stands up and in silent protest turns his back on the Secretary of State. Ray McGovern, 71 years old, former CIA analyst, prepared the daily intelligence briefing for four United States presidents. I think probably people knew who he was that day in Washington, D.C. He stands up. He's 71 years old. He stands up and, in expressing his First Amendment rights, turns on the Secretary of State silently. And they beat him bloody and threw him in jail. Obedience is not allowed. Resistance is futile. Not in this country. Not anymore. It's amazing to me. I came of age in a time of resistance in this country. Now I hardly recognize the country I grew up in. The trouble is that once you see it, you can't unsee it. And once you've seen it, keeping quiet, saying nothing becomes as political an act as speaking out. There's no innocence. Either way, you're accountable. Unfortunately, I saw it, and I couldn't unsee it. So I walked away. I had a job for life. I was a tenured full professor, and I won all the awards and all that. I was actually banned from teaching in my home department for the last several years I was there. I was asking students to think, to question the dominant paradigm. So I was teaching poetry in prisons. So I was paid to not show up. Can you imagine? Paid to not show up, a job for life. But I couldn't live at the apex of empire and point out the dark underbelly of the industrial economy and look myself in the mirror. You just can't do that for an extended period of time. I couldn't unsee it. So now what? Now what for me is walking away from empire. I live decidedly outside mainstream culture in agrarian anarchy. Anarchy is not chaos, by the way. Chaos is an absence of rules. Anarchy is an absence of rulers. In anarchy, you take responsibility for yourself and for your neighbors. I used anarchy in my classrooms for 15 years at the University of Arizona. Where I live now, people take responsibility for their neighbors, human and otherwise. That's anarchy. I live at the edge of empire, still in the empire, because there's no escape. Off the grid, in a straw bale house I refer to as the mud hut, promoting a gift economy and living a gift economy. Your mileage might vary. So I don't know what this means for you. Near-term collapse of the set of living arrangements we call industrial civilization. Near-term human extinction. I don't know what that means for you. I barely know what it means for me. I had to act in a way that matched my moral imperative. I recognize that that's almost impossible. Which reminds me of a line from The Princess Bride, as most things do. Greatest movie ever made. You remember when he was almost dead? And they took him to Billy Crystal. And Billy Crystal says, well, he's almost dead. And there's a big difference between dead and almost dead. So responding to this existential crisis we face is almost impossible. It's paralyzing. It's debilitating. But it's not quite impossible. So I want you to keep that in mind. If you want more of this, and who wouldn't? You can follow my writing at naturebatslastguidingperson.com, and I write a monthly essay at Transition Voice as well. And I want to thank everybody for being here, and thank you very much. I'd be happy to entertain any questions or comments.
You've just heard Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson with his speech at the Bluegrass Bioneers Conference in Louisville, Kentucky, November 2nd, 2012. Find a link to the YouTube video at guymcpherson.com or in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. I am Alex Smith. My thanks to Ben West of yurt.com for the video and Guy McPherson for telling it like it is.